Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I think we'll make a start. My name's James Wilson from the Royal Society in London. I'm going to be moderating this second panel session. Just a couple of process points before we kick off. I've been asked to remind participants and speakers that as this is an open meeting, there may be journalists present. I'm not quite sure if we're supposed to be encouraged or perturbed by that fact. But secondly, we've been asked just to clarify the outputs of the meeting. Through the joint efforts of the organising team, the National Academies, the Royal Society, the OECD, just to let you know that there will be a transcript of the entire meeting that the National Academies will be pulling together and putting on their website. And then we at the Royal Society and the OECD will be producing a summary document which will try and distill more of the essence of the discussion over these 2 days. So that will, those will all be available as soon as we can make them so after the meeting. Our second session is looking now at government perspectives and approaches. We've already touched this morning on globalisation and its implications for where synthetic biology research takes place and also how we govern and regulate it. As Sheila Jasanoff reminded us in the last session, we need a richer comparative understanding of the national cultures of innovation in this area in order to recognise both the differences as well as the opportunities for collaboration and eventual harmonisation. Arden Bement gave us an excellent overview of the context for Symbio research here in the US. We're now going to hear two perspectives from the UK and then from China. Our first speaker is Professor Adrian Smith. Adrian is the Director General of Science and Research in the UK's Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, which covers all public science and research investment. Prior to taking up that role last year, he was Principal of Queen Mary in the University of London. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society and a past President of the Royal Statistical Society. After Adrian, we're then going to hear from Huaming Yang, who is the founder and director of the Beijing Genomics Institute, well known for his contribution as part of the Chinese team feeding into the Human Genome Project. BGI is now the third largest centre for genomics research in the world, with campuses in Shenzhen, Hangzhou, Shanghai, Wuhan, and Tibet, and is involved in a number of large international collaborative projects. So we're very pleased to have them both here, and I'm now going to hand over to Adrian Smith.
Well, thank you for that. Good morning, everybody. We had a fabulous session earlier on the very big picture challenges and opportunities scientifically and the implications of that science. What I'm going to talk about now brings that slightly more down to earth from the perspective of a government funder. In my job, I look after the strategy and the spend of all the money in the UK that goes through our research councils and goes into our universities for research. And currently, that's about $9 billion a year. To understand the UK, we have two broad ideas. One is that the government has a legitimate role in setting overall funding strategy for science and research. But once it's made those overall big picture strategic decisions and the funding has gone to the agency, there is a line drawn and essentially the government and ministers have no role in detailed decision-making about that expenditure, about the particular programs and the particular people and the particular centres to whom it goes. In addition to the money that comes out of the ministry, goes through the research councils and to the universities, we also aid and abet various national partners, the Royal Academy for Science, the Royal Academy for Engineering. And in the UK, we have other partners in the funding business, including very powerful medical charities like the Wellcome Trust. So we have to try and join together in a synergistic way overall strategy. And that, of course, would include how do we think systematically now and what should be our strategies in relation to synthetic biology. And I won't comment on, you know, the nature of synthetic biology. We had a fabulous presentation on that a little earlier. So how much does one spend on synthetic biology? And the numbers I'm quoting here are, of course, totally misleading because there are vast tracts of basic science in biology and chemistry which are intimately connected with synthetic biology and also work that's going on in engineering. So what I'm going to quote to you now is money that we have released with the specific words synthetic biology somehow to do with it. And that currently is totaling about $15 million. Dollars at the moment. Our three main research councils that are involved in this business, we have a research council for biotechnology and biological sciences, engineering and physical sciences, and medicine. They're clearly at the forefront of pushing the science. But can I keep going back to the big issue of the last session and was also raised in the keynote speech at the beginning? We have taken on board right from the very beginning that the funding of the science and the thinking about the implications of the science has to proceed in parallel. So we have two other research councils, the Economic and Social Research Council and the Arts and Humanities Research Council, and we are also interested in funding them in parallel along the lines of the kind of integration of the science and the thinking about the implications of the science that we heard about earlier. But first, just let me say something about the actual science. In bringing together colleagues from communities in various parts of the engineering spectrum and the biological spectrum, we have, I think, an initial task to actually get the right people talking together and using the right kind of language. So we are systematically funding a number of networks covering eight of the leading scientific and engineering institutions to deliberately foster the kind of multidisciplinary conversations and the creation of a language where those communities can get together, in addition to exploring the toolkits and the technological challenges. There's too much detail on this slide, but just to give some kind of flavor, in those networks, the networks are covering the wide range of stuff that you heard talked about earlier, the putting together of the modules, the toolkits, looking specifically at areas of plant biology, and linking that to industry. And we didn't hear too much about the industrial commercial stuff later, but part of our strategy, all the way along the line, we're trying to look out for and integrate possibilities of industrial involvements. And clearly in the agricultural setting, that's highly relevant. A lot of stuff on engineering design and the modularization, and just a few other sort of topic headings of that kind that I won't dwell on. But bringing in modelers, bringing in the mathematical community, and linking, if you look at the second bullet there, linking right from the very beginning the ethical issues. So forming networks, getting people from the engineering, the biological, and the social science communities talking right from the beginning about all the issues that we've heard of. In addition to spreading the money out in the networks and trying to encourage those multidisciplinary conversations, we have also funded a center at Imperial College in London. The center within Imperial College's Institute of Systems and Synthetic Biology. And at the same time, linking that funding to another London institution, a social science institution, London School of Economics, which has a center for research and policy on the social aspects of the life sciences and biomedicine. So we're trying to build in right from the very beginning the two kind of themes, the two strands that people talked about in the last session. And that center, the aim of the center, is really to stand back and identify the big challenges both within synthetic biology, then to look at how we establish the relevant research clusters, which would typically involve multiple university institutions, and to link that through to the social aspects of everything that we're doing. And in addition, to engage as we go along the industrial and business community with the issues and the opportunities, to also have some kind of systematic view of what are the implications of all this for things like intellectual property, because we're entering new domains here, and collaborative possibilities with industry. So over something like a five-year time horizon, we want to use these centres to actually systematise what we're trying to do overall in the UK. The international dimension, I think, seems to everybody immensely important in this particular space. The first talk this morning just referred in passing. What we did do, our Engineering Physical Sciences Research Council, together with NSF, had in April of this year a so-called sandpit. The image is that of little children scrabbling around and playing and seeing what they can make and find, which seems entirely appropriate. And that was incredibly popular. A lot of people wanted to come, and it acted in a tremendous way to stimulate and identify mutually viewed promising areas of synthetic biology and to look for ways of funding new collaborations in the first instance between the US and the UK. And so we've agreed in principle through the funding agencies to follow this up and actually do some systematic funding. So on the UK-US front, that's what we've done so far. The UK, of course, is deeply part of Europe. And so looking across the spectrum in terms of European activities, in very broad brush terms, one of the big funding streams in Europe are the framework programs for research and technological development and conglomerates of universities and business from several different countries within Europe, perhaps with other partners as well, apply for funds there, and the sort of level of funds we're talking about are kind of 50 billion over the period of the framework. Within that, there is a program called NEST, New and Emerging Science and Technology, that has taken some particular interest in synthetic biology and funded a number of projects. We have an enterprise, and I think somebody is here from that enterprise, Tessie, towards a European strategy for synthetic biology, trying to work out a roadmap for Europe. And then we have other entities which are looking at commercial aspects and looking at educational infrastructure needs. So there is a lot going on in that European space. In terms of policy issues, how in the UK are we trying to grope our way towards a coherent set of policies and attitudes? Well, I'm thinking carefully, the press being in the room. It can often be the case, at least in the UK, that an initiative which is launched from government is already suspicious in some sense. And so within the UK, it is often most constructive to use arm's-length entities like the National Academies, the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering, and the research councils, which are at arm's length from government, to actually drive the conversations and start the dialogues. And that's what we've been doing, and there's a recent major project paper from the Royal Academy of Engineering in the UK, for example, looking at a vision for the future of synthetic biology. And all the time, each of these entities are enjoined and encouraged, and in a sense have to, look at the societal and ethical implications as we go along. On the ethical side, in Europe, there is actually a group which has been charged, in addition, to look at issues around the ethics of synthetic biology. We do not have an all-singing, all-dancing UK policy and strategy. So I think we may all be in the same position, that we're groping our way towards what does all this mean, and sorting out the opportunities and the implications in much the same way as the debate started just a little while ago before coffee. But what we can, however it turns out, there are certain things that we know we want to do and have to do. So for example, something again I don't think was mentioned very explicitly so far, the skills. What are the sets of skills, training, education that are needed to create that next generation who are going to contribute in this interface space between engineering and biology? How do we improve those skills? How do we strengthen overall capability, whatever that might mean. It might mean infrastructure, it might mean more bodies. What's the best way of driving forward innovation? I mean, should there be a diversion of funds into some large pot called synthetic biology and people now play in that space, or is that premature and we should let people play in their own spaces and define them and then a little further along the line work out what actually it is that synthetic biology means? And certainly within the UK context, in parallel with the scientific development and the ethics and the societal aspects, the commercialization, what does all that mean? How is that going to work? How are we going to encourage it? How are we going to get the right kind of balance between, if you like, the science and the commercialization? Then there's the issue of regulatory frameworks. And just to say what we're starting from, the entities that we have in the UK with responsibilities that you might broadly say are in the area of synthetic biology, we have a government department for environmental, food and rural affairs, and of course we have a health and safety entity. Within the health and safety executive, there is a particular entity called the Scientific Advisory Committee on Genetically Modified Organisms. Now, synthetic biology obviously goes much wider than that, but there are armies of lawyers and others, I think, looking at our current legislation and regulation, trying to see if there are things that aren't actually covered when we did the genetically modified organisms regulatory frameworks that are emerging, and do we need new regulations? And so far, there doesn't seem to be a view that we need any immediate massive new legislation. Let me go back to skills, which is just a word. It means education, training in any broad sense that you want. We are encouraging a number of leading universities to actually systematically look at what it would mean to create master's degrees and PhD programs with a label synthetic biology. So that just lists a few of the things that are going on. In particular, it's interesting that the structure that Imperial College is building in and around this has attracted wider interest in Europe as a possible model for a master's degree that would be recognized across Europe. I feel very guilty at the title of this slide, of course, because, as we know, there is no such thing as the public and society, or at least... I now know that. But I would find it rather difficult to write a slide and give a discourse that wasn't 30 pages long without some kind of shorthand. So you can construe the word public in whatever way you want that makes sense in connection with this slide. But clearly, there is a dialogue with somebody out there or some people out there. Yes, can do dialogue as well. Well, if you're going to go the whole hog, let's deconstruct business, innovation, and skill. So let's be grown up and say, you know what I mean. A recent document I draw your attention to, the Royal Academy of Engineering, was the first, I think, thing that's gone out on what we might construe as a public dialogue. We have various kind of surveys going on to try and understand in some inclusive way public perceptions and reactions. And we have had bad experiences in the UK and Europe, as was mentioned earlier, with the whole GM saga. And so there are strenuous efforts made to try and understand and deconstruct the history of that and how not to go there again. That is not to say we know the answers, but we at least know what the problems were, and we're trying to understand better how to conduct the dialogues in the future. Now, even worse than the word public, I run a unit called the Science and Society Unit, and the point of this is a recognition within the research and the science base in the UK, and I think, you know, we embedded this quite early on in the piece in the UK, particularly following the GM stuff, that you cannot look strategically at the development of the science base without linking it all the time to the social science and humanities insights
into the implications and all the processes. So we have an actual unit which is trying to think through all these issues, in particular things about communication, about dialogue, engagement, confidence, whatever. And we have a number of working groups that we've set up with heavyweight external folk in the UK, many of whom are drawn from the humanities and social science background. So we have a group, for example, on science and trust, which is doing a major kind of study as to what does that mean. We have a group on science and the media, because a lot of public understanding is mediated through media opinion formers. And so we have a strong central recognition of the social science, humanities, and the implication aspects, and we are trying, through these various mechanisms, to get that level of engagement. In terms of a national strategy, here are the four things still on the table that we're trying to work through. And if any of you have answers, please send them to me on a postcard in London. What should be the role of government in stimulating activity and driving innovation? The particular role of government and government funding. Another question, within the framework of investing in science and innovation, particularly within the UK, obviously, any major changes of direction or emphasis have to be tensioned against the implications of other spends, whether it be climate change or whatever. How do we come to a view of that kind of prioritization? What responsibility should government take, government and its agencies take, for the policy issues in and around security, ethics, and public dialogue? And who are the other players? Who else has those responsibilities? And then finally, what is the positioning, if you're a national funder, in terms of what you take on and try and drive, perhaps for national advantage or commercial advantage, at a national level versus things that we should be doing and cooperating on at the international level? So those are the things we are pondering. Thank you for your attention.
Adrian, thank you for that very clear and helpful overview, and particularly those questions at the end, which I hope we'll come back to in discussion. We won't, however, take questions now, but we'll move straight on to our second speaker, Dr. Huanmin Yang, who'll tell us about the same context in China.
I'm very happy to be here. I think you would agree with me that it is a privilege to be a scientist because we have friends all over the world. That's the first reason for me to thank the organizers to give me this opportunity to have met all the friends, even not so many, and to make many, many more new friends in another community. Perhaps I'm not the right person to talk about the government perspective. Only here, as the chief scientist of the omics project, including genomics, proteomics, structural biology, I would be involved, if not so much, in the policy making in China in natural sciences. But I'm also co-vice chairman of EGLES, European Action on Global Life Sciences, with the slogan, "Raise the banners of science and the community." It is supported by both the government and the non-governmental organizations. That it is true that another reason for me to thank the organizer is to discuss such an important, a new issue with you all. I would say we are talking about something with the aim which is so ambitious, as big as to put a man on the moon, and we are doing something to change the definition of biology. From life is what we want to know to life is what we make it. That's my personal or general understanding of synthetic biology. We are talking about a new branch of science which would change the whole world and change the future of man. I think many of you would be familiar with this term, or this title, Biology and the Future of Man. I do think that synthetic biology is one of the biggest or most influential breakthroughs in life sciences. We all know that global civilization, social progress, and scientific development all depend on technological breakthroughs like synthetic biology. I'm quite confident that this science will have its significant impacts on our life and on our world, on our environment, on the whole globe. I would like to congratulate on our colleagues for their success and achievements in the field of synthetic biology. For those in the United States, like him, we all know, and then for those done in another way, also in the States, and especially for this report, which I'm so deeply impressed. It's embarrassing for me to give the talk this time that China almost has not done anything again, a latecomer, as it did before in many other fields. For preparing this report, I have searched for synthetic biology in the public database of all Chinese governmental funding agencies and just have found so few projects already funded by the government. Actually, the first one in my institute beginning at October 2006 was funded by EC. Thanks to the help from Victor, he is also here. Thank you for giving our the opportunity to be involved. And then I also searched for all the publications related to synthetic biology by Chinese in China. Only 14 articles by five groups in Beijing, in Shanghai, in Tianjin, in Chengdu, as well as in Taipei. But trust me, in a few years, you will see the situation will be totally changed. Please don't say that China has benefited us too much from international collaboration in the past decades. In return, now China is contributing a lot, at least in my field, genomics. For example, for the biggest project in this field, the 1,000 Genomes Project, Beijing Genomics Institute, my BGI, will contribute at least 20%. All the data will be freely available in return for the help from you all. If we say that in the past, BGI would have been regarded as a showcase for genomics, with these now we call the conventional sequencers, we have done something on the rice, on the silkworm, other genomes. Now the situation has been totally changed. And we are regarded as the third biggest center in sequencing concerning its capacity and the contribution. Now you can see we have stably maintained our output, 350 megabases per week or 50 GB per day. I'm afraid it would be almost the biggest producer of sequencing data. And in the past, we have all the computers. Now we have expanded our capacity of bioinformatics or computing significantly. And we also have developed many softwares for the second generation sequencers for assembly and for RNA sequencing and for epigenomics and the metagenomics. And we have de novo reassembled the first Asian genome sequences and found that the difference between Asians and Europeans are much bigger than we expected before. We also have done, also under the umbrella of international collaboration, the whole genome exomic sequencing. we have just finished the de novo sequencing of the giant panda and the cucumber genomes. Also, as a part of the international collaboration, we have sequenced more than 200 metasamples of human intestine tracts, and we also began to sequence all the samples, or as many as we can collect of pathogenic sequences, bacteria and others, like the Yersinia pests, including both pathogenic and non-pathogenic strains. We have just initiated the 1,000 plant genomes in collaboration with our colleagues in Canada, I'm sure, which would contribute a lot to the designing of synthetically synthesized genome, which or as we know, discovery and the elucidation of more metabolic pathways, signal transduction pathways, and the gene expression regulation networks are fundamental to synthetic biology. This example has already been told by us that this one, terpenoids, is a big contribution by Chinese for treatment of malaria. But now this can be produced in an industrial scale by our colleagues by means of synthetic biology. That's another example. The synthetic biology would change a lot of the biotech. As a genomicist, I would look at a synthetic biology in another point of view, that synthetic biology is a natural, reasonable development or further extension of genomics. Now, we are reading genome sequences. And in synthetic biology, we are going to write genome sequences. I'm surprised myself by this complaint. The program of life was written 4 billion years ago. It's time for us human beings now to rewrite the program. I'm afraid many people would be shocked by this claim. I don't know from in one decade whether synthetic biology would be accepted by the majority or not. What I'm concerned is any breakthrough in science would have another problem. For example, we all acknowledge, especially as scientists, that science has brought us all good things. But if we look at all the troubles, especially the recent global economic crisis, then we cannot deny that science, at least, is partially to blame. This is an imbalanced world. I do think the communication and the collaboration and mutual friendship, mutual understanding, and mutual trust among scientists, among us from various countries, would be much more important than ever before. Would it be at least equally important as during the period of the Cold War? I would say that synthetic biology should not create more differences or more troubles, or to make the differences already there even bigger. That sense, unify us. I would call that to turn an institute's or a country's project to an internationally collaborative project. I would like here again to call for more developing countries to join. That's actually what I said when we had the first meeting on the International Cancer Genome Consortium. What can we do? Everything can be done by one or few countries, especially by USA and the UK. But everything would be done better through international collaboration. From at least, we can have better communication and exchange of our ideas. And second, we might possibly have better coordination of effort and the resource worldwide, there will never be too much resource in a single country. The third, if we can coordinate data release or data sharing policies, if we can reach consensus on patenting and other intellectual property rights issues, and then the things would be done better. And finally, we are facing the challenges from the public, especially from bioethics community, for the biosafety, for the biosecurity, and bioethical issues. If we have a sort of coordination or consortium, definitely we would have better responses to those challenges. And for me, I would like, as we already have done for the Human Genome Project, Human HapMap Project, Human Cancer Genome Project, we might also have a Chinese synthetic biology consortium to coordinate the effort and resource in China to contribute to the international community of synthetic biology. As a scientist in a developing country like China, I fully understand the importance of bioethical discussions and self-responsibility or self-governance inside the scientific community. As I claimed in 1984, when I turned to China, I told my colleagues what we bring back should not only be the advanced technology, but also the internationally acknowledged ethical principles, which is equally important and seriously regarded in China. And as a scientist who is involved in these issues, I said several times I would be extremely ashamed as a scientist that what we have discussed at this meeting could really take place. It's a meeting on biological and the toxin weapon conventions. I think you all would not misunderstand me. I'm not going to tell you that the synthetic biology would be misused to harm the people, but I would like to alarm, to tell myself the risk is there. Perhaps you have not been told of all those terrible stories at those meetings. Some of our colleagues are doing something which would be very, very difficult to be accepted by most of us. It reminds me of a book which I love so much. It was published here. Perhaps many of you would have been involved writing this book. It is titled Biology and Future of Man. The Chinese version was just published at the end of that riot in China. I would like to follow the title Synthetic Biology Under the Future of Man. Chapter 20 of that book was really excellent. Or the summary of the whole book. It talked about the nature of a human being. It talked about the great hazards. Now we say challenges, especially the opportunities. I love it. I would like to quote from it. Human being, the creation of nature, has transcended her from a product of circumstances. He has risen to responsibility. At last, he is man. May he be held so. Nothing would be done by scientists in China without international collaboration. It would be also the case for synthetic biology. I would like to quote again a Chinese proverb to thank the organizer, to thank you all for your attention. That is, when you drink the sweet water from the well, please don't forget who helped dig it.
Thank you very much.
Wan Ming, thank you very much for that very encouraging presentation. And I hope we'll be able to touch now in the discussion on this balance between competition and collaboration in Symbio. We've got 15 minutes or just a few more minutes than that now for questions. As before, if you could introduce yourselves and keep your remarks down to a minimum to allow for a proper response.
Thank you, James. Robert Winston, Imperial College London. Just a comment and then a question to Adrian Smith, if I may. It is wonderful to hear great words of how we're going to collaborate, but it is a little unfortunate that we can't even begin to agree about the issue of carbon and energy usage with the various countries in the world at the moment. That seems to me to be a very serious issue that we need to just remember when we're talking about collaboration. The other thing I really want to ask, particularly Adrian, is a question about the government and economy. And it is that recently we've heard more and more rhetoric from our government in Britain, but also governments, I think, in Europe, that science would improve our economic potential to the extent that now, of course, science is seen to be more and more an economic driver. Does he see any risks in that, particularly as people in the public may feel somewhat disenfranchised from being able to take a proper part in how science is being used in the future?
Adrian, can you?
In terms of issues of general international collaboration, I mean, I don't have any particular words of wisdom. I mean, it is depressing and it makes one slightly pessimistic, the difficulties that have been had over climate change and curing rates of carbon release, et cetera, et cetera. I think we just have to keep plugging away at it. If I may say so, the U.S. is a major player in this field, and as I read it, all the signals from the U.S. in recent times should give us greater grounds for optimism than perhaps recently. In terms of science as an economic driver, this is a very interesting and double-edged weapon. In the UK, the investment in science over the last 10 years has been such that if you look more broadly, you could say that's been a golden age, and the rhetoric in and around the importance of science has been enormously encouraging. And part of the rationale for politicians to line up behind that and to believe it have been the studies that have linked scientific innovation with greater productivity and growth. So on the one hand, it has been good for investment in science that rightly or wrongly it is believed that science is an economic driver. The danger is that that rhetoric then turns in on itself and you begin to be selective about the science you fund, thinking that you know the bits that are going to be the economic drivers. And so it is the job for all grown-ups to keep arguing and presenting the evidential database, which demonstrates over and over again the time lags of the impact of science, the serendipity, and to do case studies where some of the major effects, you know, £30 billion monoclonal antibody businesses around the world came from scientific serendipity, not from focused research programs. And it's the job of people like myself to keep conducting that dialogue with government ministers.
I just have a very brief comments on these two issues. First, when we talk about international collaboration, I think for me, I would rather pay more attention to the personal understanding, personal trust, because any official governmental collaborative projects would be based on the personality and the friendship of the, how to say, the people who are doing it, scientists. Then second, now I'm afraid, just as far as I know, in the developing or relatively poorer countries, the people would expect too much from science and forgetting the importance of political system and democracy or something else. But in the developed or relatively richer countries, people or the public would have a trend against the sense. Perhaps they think sense has already done too much good. Now sense would do more harm than good. We need a balance. Thank you.
Take one from this side.
Mike Imperiali, University of Michigan. I also have a question for Adrian Smith. In your efforts to engage the public in a dialogue, have you also involved the media, so journalists and those sorts of folks?
That's a very simple one to answer. Yes, I think the media, fundamentally important quality not only of scientific journalism, but the editorial opinion-forming aspect of the media. Certainly in the UK, there are a substantial number of very influential opinion formers who are quite key. So we're trying to do two things. One is to get more scientific education into schools of journalism, but also to cultivate and make friends with and not see as a constant enemy the opinion formers in the media.
And over here.
There's a question also for Adrian Smith. I'm Adriano Henny. I'm now an independent consultant, formerly in the pharmaceutical industry. I completely support the idea of the engagement of the social sciences and the ethicists in driving forward these discussions as you develop where you go. I think what was missing for me in your presentation is an understanding of where the impact is going to come in terms of benefiting society and the economic impact in turn. So the question really is, how are you going about engaging industry as a partner in ensuring that the academic output has its right focus in order to generate that impact? Are you doing the same sort of thing? And I think it's nice that you brought up the monoclonal story, because of course it may have been serendipity, but it was a hugely missed opportunity in the UK when it was not picked up at a time and recognized. And I think that if you had that opportunity and that engagement, it might have been.
Okay, if the broad question is in my part of the world, the dialogue with industry, that we do a great deal of and a lot more than we did two or three years ago. We regularly meet with major scientific industrial players. We meet with the Confederation, with British industry. We have joint working parties. We are bringing in people from that sector to sit on these major bodies, which are trying to look at issues like science and trust. So I think we're trying to do an awful lot, which is another way of saying I totally accept and recognize that these are major players that we have to deal with. In terms of communicating societal benefit, there was a bit on a slide that I didn't point to. We have a campaign which is very much aimed actually just segmenting the market, which is another way of admitting that the public is a very varied beast. If you segment the market into how you get the attention of young children about the importance of science, we actually have a media campaign running, which is called Science So What? And the answer to the so what can be in terms of sport, it can be in terms of health, and these are full of images and follow-up tracks and follow-up web connections where you try and sow the seeds of the question, and then you answer it with a huge range of benefits which are closely related to the person who is responding to the question, science, so what? I'm not saying we know exactly how to do all this, but we're trying a lot of novel techniques to get at that kind of communication.
Another one over here.
So I'm Richard Kitney from Imperial College London, and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Synthetic Biology. And Adrian mentioned that we have a strategy in terms of synthetic biology, which I developed with Paul Fremont, my colleague. Now, one of our key points of our strategy at Imperial is to marry both research and education. We see this as being incredibly important. And indeed, as chairman of the Royal Academy of Engineering report, we also built that into our report. And we are now, we've got our program of our MRes and PhD program working at Imperial, but we're also now working with colleagues at Genopole in France to develop a European-wide master's program. So my question actually for both speakers, but initially for Adrian, is to really ask you whether you are in agreement that what you need in this area is a joint approach, a sort of a two-pronged attack on this problem. One is to develop the research in terms of, let's say, major universities, but in parallel with that, to also develop the educational program to build up the manpower to tackle this problem.
Easy one to answer. I totally agree. I think we have not systematically addressed that in the past, and we are planning to have a major national review of more generally than synthetic biology, but addressing the question of the need for a national strategy for postgraduate education.
Okay, thanks.
Kwan Ming, do you want to add anything?
I would say, I don't know, many discussions are related to culture or not, and we are just talking about the press media, about education. For press media, it's very important for us to make friends with the editors, with the journalists. I think we cannot avoid communication with them. For something I really cannot understand, that's the fate of GM in the UK, as well as the human embryonic stem cell. The latter stem cell is so popular in the UK by the public, right? And the GM still now is rejected. What's the difference? And then it's related to genomics, especially for the human genome research. I have told the public in different ways many, many times the risk is much bigger than embryonic cells and then GM. But I still got the supports, at least as far as I know, in China from the public. Do we have to think of something and then do something before it is too late, and don't simply blame the press media and blame the ignorance of the public? And the second, concerning the education, of course, until now, in China, we don't have any education directly related to synthetic biology. But we did a lot for genomics or for other fields of life sciences. I myself wrote the preface of the most popular textbook for middle school children, and also a dialogue with a press media to answer many questions related to genomics, also as the first part of the textbook of so-called natural sciences. I think it would be obligation for us as scientists to directly talk with the press media and the kids. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've got about 6 questions and 5 minutes left, so I'm going to suggest that we just take the 6 questions and then come back to the panel for final remarks. So we'll start here and yo-yo across the room. Okay.
Sibylle Geiser, Fraunhofer Institute for Systems and Innovation Research in Germany. As Adrian Smith mentioned, we developed a European roadmap for the development of synthetic biology in Europe, and which addresses the different dimensions in which how you could stimulate synthetic biology. And I would like to know whether you've got a similar approach in China. This would be very helpful in order to match activities in Europe and in China and stimulate collaboration.
Thank you. Sheila.
Sheila Jasner from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. I have a quick question for Adrian Smith and a more general one for both of you. The quick question is, was there a public consultation or dialogue over the decision that synthetic biology needed no different regulation from GM in general? And the more general question is, you've talked a lot about communication, dialogue, understanding, and so on and so forth. Do you think either scientists or policymakers need any special skills in order to engage in those activities? And if so, whose responsibility do you think it is to provide those skills?
Thank you. Over here.
I'm Sithian Pandian from Department of Health in Canada. I am the policy manager for emerging sciences. The policy on synthetic biology, as has been nanotechnology for some time internationally is that we have the existing regulations sufficient to deal with the products that are coming into the market. I have a slightly difficult situation in taking that position. I believe this is because the regulatory community has come to the conclusion that we are unable to define how to describe the new materials that are coming to us, whether it is nanomaterial or products derived out of synthetic biology. Going back to a situation 15 years or 20 years ago with biotechnology, we were reasonably clear about the nature of genetic engineering. The science was pretty clear to us, and therefore we could describe the boundaries of genetic engineering, and therefore we could tell the industry, this is what we are going to regulate from now on. New regulations and acts came up. We are unable to do that now because we do not know how to describe the boundaries of this.
Okay.
Based on what happened in Asilomar conference in 1973, the community of scientists is unable to bring out a self-regulating boundary to these new products. We cannot afford to postpone the change of new definition of these new materials and new technologies in order to define a process for regulation of these new products. We cannot deal with it with the current regulation. It is going to go out of our hands pretty soon.
Okay, thank you. I think that...
Excuse me. I just missed it. What country are you from?
Canada.
Canada. Okay. Canada. Okay, quickly, we've got three more, and then we'll come back to the panel.
Ken Oi from MIT, Ensenberg. Both panelists have spoken with real passion on the need for partnership in terms of collaboration on development of the technologies internationally and on sharing of the fruits of the technologies. If we look to climate change talks right now, we see big fights, both in the public sessions and in the private sessions, over sharing, specifically over intellectual property rights. And if we look ahead a little bit, one can anticipate fights over security, with security-based regulations limiting the diffusion of skills, crafts, and education. To the panelists, in the near term and in the long term, to what extent do you believe that intellectual property rights conventions and their invocation and or security regulations here pose threats to the kind of sharing and partnership that you envisage?
And I think now already three questions, we just divided them into two parts.
Well, we'll just take these two and then we'll come back.
Okay. Andrew Maynard. Thanks. Andrew Maynard, Woodrow Wilson Center. From a policy perspective, do you think that having an emphasis on synthetic biology is ultimately going to enable progress, however you define progress, or do you think it could ultimately create barriers in and of itself which are harder to overcome and thus inhibit progress?
Finally, Paul Rabinow.
Paul Rabinow, Berkeley. I taught a course once on AIDS, and the midterm question was, compare AIDS to another epidemic. And the epidemic you compared it to told you a lot about how you were approaching AIDS. So I would say the same thing here. We've heard about GMOs now 8 or 9 times. What about mad cow disease?
Okay, there's far more there than you can answer in a minute, Adrian and Harming, but have a go, and we'll do the rest over lunch.
Okay, I just briefly answer several of the questions. The first, concerning whether China has a sort of roadmap in synthetic biology to match those in UK and USA, I would say no. That's really my failure. I have tried to convince the Chinese authorities to fund synthetic biology. Until now, the achievements are very limited or poor. And I strongly proposed to the 50 years vision by CAS. Now, there is a short paragraph about the synthetic biology, but I'm still working together with my colleagues, especially those in Shanghai, we will catch up. And the second, I'm so interested in your question in Canada concerning the regulation, right? That's really very sad. Now, the rule by scientists in any policy making and the regulation is less, smaller and smaller. I really have to tell you, at least in China, as far as I know, also in many other countries, so-called, how to say, emerging country, developing country, now it's very difficult for the policymakers. Just to take, again, GMO as an example. For China itself, they would agree with the USA. They need GMO, GM food, GM crops, to feed such a huge population. Then also under the strong pressure, perhaps just because of the big surplus of the trading between US and China, China has to import a lot of GM food. Just last year, 30 million cubic tons of GM soybean. Half from South America, half from North America. And then China still cannot make the position that the GM food, mainly GM rice, legal in China. That's the, how to say, under the pressure from the EC, EU countries. So you see, is this a scientific issue? That's exactly what I'm concerned of the future of synthetic biology. Finally, we will have nowhere to speak out our opinions. And then concerning the international partnership, especially the industry and the companies, it's really, really a challenge to me. For Human Genome Project and the following HaveMap, you know, I have been one of the active advocates for free sharing. I do think the upstream knowledge concerning genome, just because it is so important to all of us, must be freely shared. Otherwise, China is not so bad. If we patented this basic knowledge, and then the framework would be fixed, that those people who are coming earlier to this field will be the always winner. And then how to balance? And then I'm seriously criticized by my colleagues that they sell our country resource. Even now they say, why do you sequence so much, publish so much? It's for nothing. They also need something to patent, need something for the companies to earn money, right? That's the first challenge I cannot answer. And for the synthetic biology, it's even more difficult. But I still hope we can separate two fields, something which should be shared freely, something could be patented individually. Then the second concerning what we should publish, what not, it immediately reminds me of the pathogen genomes. I don't know, in the future someday, I myself would be a criminal because we have published so many pathogens, SARS, influenza viruses, avian, and the swine. And then now it's so easy to list the chemical and synthesize a genome as small as a virus. But what would be a better choice if we did not publish it? I think no way. We have run all the risk. We have to be confident until this moment. Science has done much more good than harm. That's all. Okay. Thank you.
And Adrian, final word.
Okay, we're desperately running out of time, so no disrespect to the questions, but I'll be very, very brief. The public dialogue on regulation and is what we've got in the UK satisfactory. I think this is a moving feast, and I think there hasn't been any formal public consultation, but I think that's because some of us feel we haven't, and I think it was alluded to by another question.
that we're actually struggling a bit to understand whether we do understand the boundaries of what we're asking and how it relates to previous things. So I think that's definitely ongoing business where we don't know the answers. In terms of conducting public dialogue, does the scientific community have the skills? Absolutely not. And there's a big need to think out of the box. And one of the things we're trying to do is get kind of fabulous advertising and PR executives into the game. In terms of the sensitivity, the fights in and around security and intellectual property and the difficulty of getting at government level joined up thinking, I don't have a magic answer to that. I think those are very real issues where there are national interests that won't go away overnight. Should we raise the banner of synthetic biology in a very strident way? Does that help progress or hinder it? I actually don't know. I think the jury's out there. My own instinct is to let a lot more happen bottom up and not at this moment to create some gigantic top-down pot of money labeled synthetic biology. I want to see it emerge from the bottom up. Mad cows and the rest, you know, why does STEM work and GM not? It turns into something else, doesn't it? STEM is to do with doctors curing people and saving lives. Tick in the box. GM could have been to do with feeding the millions and saving lives. It got into another box, which was irresponsible industrial greed, so we went wrong. So one can learn what happened. It doesn't necessarily mean I think we know how to avoid it in future, but I think we know a lot about the tracks that went down in the past dialogue. Okay.
Great. Well, we're going to pause there for lunch. Please try and be back promptly at 1 for the next session on tools and techniques. But before we go, just join me in thanking again our two speakers, Adrian Smith and Guanming Yang.